as I mentioned earlier this hour, we're covering a couple events on WMUK this morning. And up next, we'll be looking at the Birds on a Wire concert, which is set for tonight at 7:30 p.m. With me to talk about it is David Colson, who founded Birds on a Wire now 8, 10 years ago or so.
I think so.
Yeah.
10 or 11.
10 or 11.
Yeah.
I love that it's a new music ensemble based on the Pierrot Lunaire configuration. So when you put together a new music ensemble these days, people refer back to a specific piece by a specific composer, which was a lovely combination of wind, strings, and maybe one voice.
In voice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the design that you founded this on, although you can bring a lot of different colors and instruments in
yeah.
and out.
That ensemble configuration is probably the most easiest to work with in terms of flexibility. So normally in the Pierrot ensemble, the core ensemble is generally one violin, cello, flute, clarinet, piano, and percussion. So 6 members. But it becomes so easy then to add another violin, another or a viola, add a double bass, add more winds. So you could have, you know, flute, oboe, clarinet, bassoon. You can add easily brass to that. So it's an ensemble that has great potential for being expanded into a larger ensemble or shrunk down into duos or trios or quartets. I think what's been interesting in the last probably 10 to 12 years, as chamber music has really expanded, both for listeners and for performers, is that new music ensembles nowadays can be of varying combinations. So it wouldn't be unusual to have a bassoon, a tenor saxophone, mm-hmm. a percussionist, a guitarist. And so we're not really, I think, regarding a new music ensemble locked into the mini orchestra that Schoenberg envisioned in 1912 with Pierrot Lunaire. But it could be any combination of things that you would want to put together. And people are doing that. And there are lots of ensembles of 2 people, lots of ensembles of 20 people, and therefore all varieties and combinations that might include instruments that we typically see in popular music or rock ensembles, or could include digital components as well. So it wouldn't be unusual to have a digital audio specialist who might be mixing things, or even a DJ.
When this eclectic group gets together at Western Michigan University, it's called Birds on a Wire. And tonight, we're going to talk about the program for tonight, which I think you had a sense of the time of year. Well, we can talk about some of these spooky, stylish pieces.
I've never done this before, but it's actually a themed concert in some ways.
Yeah. But we should also first maybe acknowledge the guest artist who's coming in to perform tonight and is one of those outstanding traveling percussionists who makes a career with a variety of projects and is really a proponent for solo percussion.
Yes. His name is Matthew Cooley, and I first met him about 2 years ago when I brought the percussion quartet that's called Clocks in Motion to our campus to perform a concert, and they returned again last year to perform a piece I'd written for them. But Matthew is part of this group. Matthew is, in many ways, the kind of percussionist that was typical of when I was growing up and when I was learning to play percussion. In the probably 30s, 40s, 50s, it wasn't unusual for a percussionist to learn a very basic set of instruments. So you might learn to play the snare drum. You might learn to play timpani. You might learn to play the xylophone. And it was those instruments that were primary in symphonic ensembles, so whether it be orchestras or bands. And of course, along the way, you'd learn to play cymbals well, and the bass drum and triangle, and the sort of collection of symphonic percussion instruments was rather modest compared to what it is today, even though you had somebody like Edgar Varèse, who wrote Ionization in 1932 for 13 percussionists and included every variety of wood, skin, metal instrument, no melodic instruments except for the piano and the chimes. But he was a visionary in terms of seeing percussion instruments as a much more global kind of view. But still, in America, with a concentration on music being imported from Europe, the percussion collection was relatively small. As you get into the 60s, there's this notion of being a total percussionist. So you learn to play the vibraphone, the marimba, the xylophone, the timpani, the multitudes of drums, including instruments from Latin America, such as congas and bongos, and African instruments, and eventually Asian instruments creep into that. Now the collection of percussion instruments that a percussionist is required or may learn to play is enormous. It reaches probably into the hundreds for sure, maybe beyond that. But any instrument that can be struck is considered a percussion instrument. So each diaspora you might go into, whether it be South America, Africa, Asia, has culturally their own set of percussion instruments. And given that probably these are amongst the first instruments that humanity learned to play and execute on, for all varieties of reasons, to be able to communicate, right? If you were in separate villages and you wanted to send a signal to the next village, you probably used a drum or a hollowed out log. And so Matthew kind of is amazing to me. Every time I turn around, he's playing a different instrument. He's an expert, like on dulcimer, stringed instruments. He can play all the melodic instruments, all the drums that are typical of percussion instruments. He really does it all. But he's just a fantastic specialist on the marimba. Ah. And this really didn't come into full consciousness, especially in higher education and the professional world, until the 70s. You did have people that played the marimba and vibraphone very well. Many of them were jazz musicians. So people like Lionel Hampton, for instance, and many other names could be clustered around that group as well. But in the 70s, you had a couple of people, Lee Stevens and Gordon Stout, principally, who began transcribing classical music from stringed instruments, from the keyboard instruments, and they really revolutionized the virtuosity and the level one could expect to enjoy in watching a solo marimbist. So that's what, roughly 40, 50 years ago now. And as each generation has come along, they get better and they get better and more interesting, and they create new music. And this is what Matthew has done. He's commissioning music for the marimba. He's performing on the marimba, in addition to being a percussionist as well. So this is what had really drew me to writing a piece for him. I had never written a solo marimba piece, even though I grew up learning to play and studied this instrument. I never wrote for the solo marimba. I always included it in ensemble pieces, but there was something sort of intimidating for me about writing a solo piece for the marimba. And I just had to force myself to do it. And I briefly talked with Matthew about writing such a piece for him, but then I didn't tell him. And this summer, I just went to town and I just bared down on it. And I wrote a 5-movement piece for solo marimba. It's about 15 minutes in length. And oddly enough, only days after I finished the piece, I happened to get an email from Matthew, just sort of like, "What's up? You know, how you doing?" sort of thing. And I went, "Well, I'm about to send you this solo marimba piece that I've written for you." And he was like, okay, good. when would you like me to come perform it?
Oh, my.
So we looked at a bunch of dates, and it looked like this would fit very well for 30 October for tonight. And so he arrives this afternoon. I haven't heard him play the piece. And it may not be until the concert that I actually hear it. And that'll be exciting.
We should tell the folks that it's called Ghost Music.
Yes.
A brand new piece called Ghost Music. And so perfectly timed for tonight, the day before Halloween.
Yes.
Did you compose this on the marimba or at the keyboard?
No, neither. I composed it at the computer. So, you know, the computer will do a MIDI playback of the marimba. It's a really poor sound. It just sounds horrible. And it's terrible to listen to. And that was part of the struggle I had, was each time I would sort of play back what I'd been working and reworking on the score, it was like, oh, this is horrible. And, but no, I didn't go to the marimba. I pretty much have that sound in my ear. It's an instrument that I started playing when I was about 9 years old. And the trouble for me at nine was I was so short that the keyboard came up to my chest, and I actually had to stand on a little box to be able to play on the instrument. But I pretty much have those sounds in my ears and knew the capacity of the instrument. And and then at that point, you just write music. You try to write beautiful music, and you know what the range of the instrument is, what the particular sounds, what the dynamic capacity is. You know all these kind of what are sort of primary things that one would expect of the instrument. But then you kind of let go of that and you try to write some interesting music.
A beautifully built marimba is a kind of a luxurious item.
Especially these days, because the bars are made out of Brazilian rosewood. I suppose probably rosewood wherever they can get it these days, since it's really an endangered kind of material. But rosewood, depending, if I'm not mistaken, the rosewood for a marimba comes from the softer part of the wood. Xylophone is usually a denser, harder kind of wood, taken closer to the core of the tree. But the rosewood for a marimba is relatively soft. And especially when you get down into the lower pitches of the instrument, and in fact, the way the pitches are actually created are not only the length of the bar, but then the underside of the bar is carved out like sort of a bridge that's whittled out and chiseled out of the bottom part of the bar. And the lower pitches of the instrument, the thickness of the bars are relatively thin. So you have to be really careful. One, in executing really forceful dynamics that you don't crack the bar.
Oh boy.
So you're paying attention to the hardness and softness of the mallet that's being used to strike the bar, but then you also have to pay attention to the force. Not that you can't get a forceful sound out of the lower part of the instrument, you just have to be aware and conscious of what you're doing and try to project the sound rather than force it out.
Oh, and here in Michigan, the temperature and humidity changing all the time.
Yes.
Yikes.
Yeah.
You have to be very careful about storing the instrument. Now, is Matthew dragging a trailer behind his car?
He is. He is.
Carrying this marimba?
He is. I think he prefers to do that. In fact, I told him I'd meet him to help him unload this afternoon, knowing that it would require some help, especially now that it's raining out. But I knew he'd be bringing his instrument, so he has a small trailer and he loads it up and drives all over the place.
I'm speaking with David Colson about tonight's concert by Birds on a Wire, featuring marimbaist Matthew Cooley, and he'll be premiering this brand new piece, Ghost Music, by David Colson. It comes about fourth on the program. So in the time we have left, why don't we look at the other pieces that
Sure.
brought together. One is by another faculty member at Western, Christopher Biggs.
Yes.
Who has really shown me new ways to hear modern music because he finds ways to unite sounds that are not acoustic with acoustic musicians in ways that can be very subtle or very striking. And it's just a fascinating journey for me, seeing these pieces come out.
Yes. You're absolutely right about the interface and the marriage he's created in his music between digital, what we often in the old days referred to as electronic music, with acoustic music. And it's really fascinating to me because when I was younger, in my teenage years, what I knew about electronic music was created by all kinds of other means that were rough and primitive. Mm-hmm. You know, doing things like taking a reel-to-reel tape recording machine and rubbing the tape back and forth across the playback heads to create distorted sounds and rhythmic passages. Or the synthesizers then were analog synthesizers, and you had to manipulate all the features of the sound, including the envelope and the kind of tone that it would generate. But you had to control all aspects of the sound, and it was rather time-consuming, laborious, and somewhat dirty in terms of the sound it produced. Now, we listen to that kind of music today with a certain kind of joy because those imperfections and the things that we recognize today that couldn't be done back then and how they had to be done makes it very interesting. But nowadays, everything is so clean, and you can strive for this perfection, and computers can very quickly profile a sound that you can craft very quickly and save gobs of time. It used to be, too, that when we made these pieces, that we would splice individual sections from magnetic tape. So I can remember being in the studio all night and, you know, splicing tape and editing it together in different kinds of ways to create interesting patterns and phrases electronically. But now you can do that so much more quickly, and it's clean and it's interesting. And I think the way it can meld with acoustic sounds is really brilliant and very exciting, I think.
Yeah, when I talk to Dr. Biggs, I always have to ask him, how does the electronic component work? Because he builds different ways to make it work almost every time. It's not, I can't take it for granted that he's going to push a button or that in some cases the players will be mic'd and he'll build a program that reacts to the sound they're making.
Yes. Essentially, it can be broken down into two this is very simplistic coming from my simplistic understanding of this is that there is a fixed media where you can create the sounds that are played side by side with the performer, but then there is live processing where the sounds that the musicians are creating are processed and then reintroduced as a separate component. So there's one is you make the piece ahead of time, and two, the other one is live, and some things come out predictable and other things are less predictable.
The piece is called Cerussis.
Cerussis.
Cerussis. I already can hear the musicality in the word, the sort of sibilant sounds. I'm just going to take a guess that that's somehow part of the program for tonight.
Well, 7:30. It's mysterious, isn't it?
It is what begins the program. Since we have about 6 or 7 minutes here, move on and mention that after Cerussis, we'll hear Matthew in a solo marimba piece.
Yes.
Called Fugue on a Chromatic Subject by Bjorn Burkout.
Yes.
Is he another percussionist as well?
You know, I don't know much about him. I believe he's just solely a composer. And I believe he was in school with Matthew. And they, you know, they're in a collection together of people he's known. And he wrote a piece, he wrote this piece for Matthew in, I think it was 2007. And it was published probably, oh, 5 or 6 years later.
We're going to hear a sample of that at the end of the hour.
Great.
But then you went all the way back to 1930.
Yes.
Was this your choice, or did a student maybe say, I want to play
both
Anton Webern?
I know. It was really interesting. There was a student that sort of simultaneously mentioned this as we were thinking about the program. And I thought, fantastic, because what I've recognized, at least in people that are studying in music schools today, they tend to gravitate towards the composers of their generation or just above their generation who tend to be on the younger side. And unfortunately, we've lost track of some of the masters from the early part of the 20th century, and certainly Anton Webern is one of those. So I like to, especially from time to time, include these pieces on the program because, one, I like them, and I think they're good pieces. And I think it's important for the students to have these experiences. And this Webern really has to be executed in a way that you typically don't execute music. I think it's closer to Mozart in many ways than it is to a lot of music of our own time. It's very delicate. It tends to be soft music. The phrases are very particular and have to be respected all the time. You have to understand what the phrase is and how it connects with the other instruments. And in this case, especially the Webern Quartet Opus 22 requires exceptional listening, because a musician may only play one or two notes. Rarely you will get a situation where they're playing three or four notes at a time. So it means that if each player is playing two or three notes, it often connects to itself. So you can hear the whole line that may start in the piano, go to the violin, go to the tenor saxophone, and then to the clarinet, or in any combination of those four instruments that make for a line. So you have to think about what's coming in front of you and how you're handing it off.
So even though you're cheated out of a full phrase,
yes,
you do get to share it in a most interesting way.
Yes.
Was that called Klangfarben Melody?
Well, certainly, yes, there is that aspect to it where you have a musical line that's being colored at different points of its execution, right? So you do hear these shifts and changes. So, yeah, you're right on the money about that. But I think you know, Webern is unique in this way. And again, because of the delicacy and the quiet, it's very pianissimo, piano music. And to try to achieve that balance is really difficult, because you have the piano, a tenor saxophone, which tends to be acoustically more overbearing than, say, the clarinet or the violin. And so trying to achieve those balances is very difficult. And the ensemble has done a great job. It's going to be a very good performance.
Birds on a Wire performs tonight at 7:30 in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. And this is part of the Live and Interactive series. And I would highly recommend arriving at 7 o'clock to get some behind-the-scenes context on the pieces on the program. They'll be introduced by the performers, composers, and by the end of the concert, you'll really have had a wonderful trip through some modern music and a world premiere of Ghost Music for Marimba by David Colson. We have maybe 2 minutes to talk about Robert Ashley's piece, which I'll let you introduce.
What's your impressions of Robert Ashley?
Well, should I know Robert Ashley? I'm not sure.
Well, He is interesting. He's no longer living. I think he's passed away a few years ago. He was born and grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And he also went to the University of Michigan. And he was part of a collection of some fascinating folks that were students at the same time. A gentleman composer named Gordon Mumma, another composer who actually, his livelihood was made as an announcer at U of M's NPR station, George Cacioppo. And then, of course, Robert Ashley, Leslie Bassett, who was on the faculty of U of M. And, of course, their teacher was a man named Ross Lee Finney, who's a very important figure in especially the early modernist American composers. And he was a great mentor for a lot of composers that went on to have fabulous careers. So Robert Ashley was part of that. He was with George Cacioppo and Gordon Mumma. They founded what was called the Once Festival, that went from about 1963 to, I don't know, 68, 69, 67, somewhere in there. But it was an important event that collected a lot of experimental and avant-garde musicians that came together to play that kind of music. He would have considered himself an opera composer, but it's not opera in the traditional kind of sense. But this is almost more performance art than it is what people would say is music. People would say, well, is this music? Uh-huh. The question I would ask is it interesting?
The title is interesting. It's called The Wolfman. So,
yeah. Again, it's part of the Halloween theme.
Yes. Wasn't there a DJ called Wolfman Jack?
Yes, there was. Yes, there was. Back in my day.
Well, that's how the piece, that's how the concert ends, and that's how our interview is going to have to end today. But I want to remind listeners to come out tonight. The concert begins at 7:30, but on the Live and Interactive series, there's always an introduction at 7 p.m. Birds on a Wire brings together a lot of very talented Western students playing all kinds of instruments. And of course, as you mentioned, Matthew Cooley is coming to town, and he will be the special guest playing your new solo marimba piece called Ghost Music. David, great to talk to you. Thanks for the preview.
Always. Thank you.
Let's hear a little bit of Matthew playing in a live concert. One of the pieces he'll play tonight by Bjorn Bergkvist. Thank you.